Well, let's start by your giving me your name, Jim, and describing how you came to be a farmer.
Well, my name is Jim Oleksik, commonly called Jim, and my family probably farmed since time began. It's not recorded. I'm the last one of the family to have been farming, and I did take over the family farm from my parents as they retired.
When you say from time immemorial, you're thinking of the old country and then coming to Canada, I guess, as well, are you?
Yes, and being in the Polish-Ukrainian area, farming was very prominent. Many, many people farmed in that area, and I'm sure they were farmers there for centuries.
When did your family come to Manitoba, I suppose, directly?
My grandparents immigrated to Canada in 1898 on both sides, and the Oleksik sides settled south of St. Norbert at the postal district of Howden on a river lot. And as the family grew to, it was eight children when they decided to move to Fannistel, where land was still largely free. It was the end of the world, but they crossed the prairie from south of St. Norbert all along the LaSalle River by horse team, horses and wagons, to Fannistel, and my dad said that it was a long one-day trip to get to the farm northwest of Fannistel. The landowner developed the farm in 1917, building a house, a barn, and plowing 100 acres. And my dad, who was 15 at the time, and my uncle, who was 16, wintered at the farm with the horses, and they both said it was an awfully long winter. Their father had told them not to go into Fannistel, but they said whenever there was a nice day, they would hitch up a horse and they would go to Fannistel to break the monotony. My dad bought a mouth organ, and my uncle bought a shotgun. So on days they would go out shooting rabbits and prairie chickens. As they said, the sky would darken with prairie chickens at that time. And my dad taught himself to play the mouth organ. Only having gone to school for 2 years, he taught himself mathematics that same winter, long division, multiplying, and sufficiently enough to carry on farming. The family moved out in the spring of 18. Everything was loaded onto the train at St. Adolphe, I believe, and including a carload of barley by hand, and it was railed out to Fannistel, where it was all taken to the farm 7 miles northwest by horse and wagons. And they began farming there, and they prospered through the 1920s, and they decided to just let the mortgage stay paying the interest, and we're buying machinery to mechanize the farm. And my parents got married in the fall of 29. My dad decided to buy a new tractor and crunched right into the Great Depression of the 1930s.
What a time to get married. Fannistel had been established as a French settlement, hadn't it? There were two of these French settlements along what is now Highway 2 out of Winnipeg. Fannistel and St. Claude, I think, were established by French settlers who came from France directly. They weren't from Quebec. And did your family have much to do with the people of Fannistel then? You were living, you said, 7 miles northwest of the town.
Yes, they patronized Fannistel as the community, including the grain elevator. And at that time, you could get everything you wanted in Fannistel. There was a blacksmith, machinery dealers, lumber dealer, which is still there, and grocery stores, and the railway station. And they patronized Fannistel. It was a two-hour drive by team to get to Fannistel. And the first machine they bought was the Model T Ford. And then you could get to Fannistel in 15 minutes.
Once
that
the
gave
roads
them mobility. Well, the Model T would go through a lot of shit, as they said.
I dare say.
But it gave them mobility to go not only to Fannistel, but to Elm Creek Ely or wherever.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the elevator in Fannisdal. Did your family deal with any specific company through the years?
One was Canadian Consolidated. But by, I think, the Fannisdal Manitoba Pool Local was established in 1926. And my uncle was on the founding board of that local.
Mm-hmm. Now, your uncle, he was the brother of your father who was at the farm. Were there the two boys in the family then?
No, there was... The last one was born at Fannisdal. There was nine in the family. There were six boys.
I see.
And
did they all farm in the area?
At one time, they all took up farming. My. Yes. land was pretty easy to take up. The established farms, well, sold for a very good price in the 20s. And like my grandfather lost his farm in the 30s and remortgaged it three times until finally the sons bought it in the late 30s. And with the coming of the Second World War, grain prices improved. And
so they didn't actually have to move off the farm. It's just that he lost the first mortgage was lost, and that he had to remortgage.
Yes, they would come back with a lower price and say, well, we got good news. We can remortgage at a lower interest and lower acreage dollars. But it was still absurd. But they didn't want the family to move off the farm. They wanted to stay there and get their rent for their...
Yes.
For their land. No, they didn't move farmers off at that time. If you stayed and farmed the land, they were happy to keep you there.
Your family tradition wouldn't remember the amount of the mortgage back in the 20s, I don't suppose.
I can't recall offhand, but it was easily in the $50 per acre. Mm-hmm. It was an established farm with improvements.
Yes. Well, without going into economic particulars, buying in 1917 would mean that he was buying fairly late in that Great War inflation, and that it didn't continue without a break. The early 20s was hard for farmers, and that's when the pools appeared. But the land values will probably have been high, and putting money into machinery rather than paying off the mortgage probably made sense in the long run, but the mortgage would continue.
Yes, it made sense, but they didn't see the Great Depression coming.
Who could?
Nobody did.
No.
Had the 30s carried on as the 20s, they would have paid for the land also and mechanized.
Yes.
But
as it was, they held on to the farm, they had the machinery, and then they had to endure the Great Depression. Do you have much in the way of family memories of what it was like farming there through the 30s?
Me, no.
And
just,
into the 40s?
Just what I was told.
Yes, of course.
I was born in 41 and start to remember the mid-40s. My dad bought a combine in 1942, so I don't remember the thrashing gangs. They were all gone in my memory. I've heard a lot about them. But
I guess we might mention that my father farmed a few miles away through those years, so we could probably be comparing experiences at times. And
yes.
I know Dad bought a combine together with a neighbor of his that he did a lot of harvesting with for some time. And it was probably about the same time, probably, that...
Yes.
But your father had the combine.
The Second World War caused a great shortage of farm equipment. As the war effort was absorbing a lot of the production. So I recall them talking about, like one of my uncles had a combine, my dad had a combine, and by 1943, the other three uncles were unable to get a crew to man their thrashing machine. So the two combines had to do the whole crop. And I believe it was 43 or 44 where it was a very wet late fall. And they finished harvesting on the day before Christmas. Fortunately, it didn't snow on them. But traveling on the ice with their steel-wheeled tractors, and they managed to take the crop off. Prices were good, although set during the war, but yes. Prices were good. Mm-hmm. And it was a struggle to get the crop off.
Well, you mentioned beginning to have memories from the late 40s. You were in school, of course, through those years, but involved with working the farm, I'm sure, as farm boys usually were.
Yes, I had older brothers, so I wasn't pressed into service at too young an age. I do remember the last of the horses going, and in fact, I remember Arnell's transfer in Fennistel with loads of horses on at night going to be slaughtered for dog food. And I asked Frenchie Arnell one time, I said, I remember you being in Fennistel at 10 o'clock at night with a load of horses on getting the truck repaired. I said, when did you get unloaded? He said, well, we'd go to Winnipeg and we'd wait and we'd get unloaded by 3 o'clock in the morning. We'd come home, sleep for a couple of hours, and then go for another load of horses. The horse era was over. Wow. And I regret not being part of the horse era, because I liked horses.
Did your family not have any horses at all after that?
We had one chore horse that stayed until Hydro came in, and then he was sold off. I remember him being sold off, and I remember our last team being sold off.
Oh, yes. Now, Hydro came through about
fall of 1948, which would have put me at 7 years old.
So the horse, my father, if I may say so, went to Winnipeg and probably bought one of those horses because we had a horse on the farm. He wanted to have a horse on the farm, but Hydro had come in 48, all right, and continued to transform life on the farms. Was your family primarily in grain growing, or did you have livestock as well? Was it mixed farming or not?
Through the 1930s, they were more mixed. But in my memory, the livestock declined, and it was primarily grain growing. Was the main source of income, for sure.
So you didn't have milk cows or...
Oh, yes. We had milk cows and hogs and chickens, yes. At that time,
of course, this was
15 dozens of eggs would just about pay your weekly grocery bill. Yeah. Or a can of cream. Yeah, we had that.
And did your father have the same view of pigs, mortgage raisers? You bring them up to a size and off to market and make the year's mortgage payment, or was that not true in your family?
No, I can recall him quoting the disastrous prices of the 30s on both cattle and
hogs. I was thinking
of
later on in the 40s and 50s.
No, I can't recall him saying that. His income was primarily grain, more so than hogs. Yeah.
Well, that's the grain trade is what we're about.
And, yes.
So when did you work the fields and do those other things that farm boys
generally did? Oh, yes. I could hardly wait to get started. We had two Case tractors on steel wheels, and I always envisioned myself becoming the engineer. But by the time I grew up, they were quite obsolete, and I started with rubber-tired tractors and was eager to get out and work the field with the older brothers and my father. And I wanted to farm very much. I was very interested. I knew every bolt in those old Case's bodies just by watching them work. And
did your family do the repair of them as well?
Yes, not that those old reliables needed a great deal of repair, but yes, they did. And they learned to be mechanics that way, as I did.
Yes. Farmers are keen on remembering the tractors they had, particularly over the years. You mentioned the two Cases. What were the rubber tire tractors?
It was a Case also. It was a newer model of the same tractor. It was rubberized. It had electrical equipment on it, but it was actually the same model underneath.
So your family was sort of oriented to the Case, J.I. Case.
Yes.
Machinery. Was there a dealer that they were patronizing, or was there some other reason?
Yes. The dealer was R.H. Stevens of Fennistel was the Case dealer.
The lumber yard, et cetera, et cetera.
But what really clinched it was that when my dad had bought a new tractor in 29 and he couldn't pay for it, the Case company was going to repossess it. And Stevens went to bat for him and said, if you repossess it, it's going to sit here in my lot and rust away. But if you let him have that tractor, he's going to pay for it if he can. And the Case company backed off, and eventually my dad did pay for it. And we stayed with Case tractors, and I retired with Case tractors.
You really? Well, that's splendid. R.H. Stevens, of course, the business that he and then the son took over later on, was a real institution in Fennistel.
Yes, he was. Stevens was more than just a lumber merchant. He was also in the grain trade, and his elevator still stands today, the Stevens Lumber, Coal, and Grain. And he was more than that. He was a private banker. People banked with him. He was paymaster for the elevator companies and marriage counselor and paralegal. He did go around to a lot of the early settlers that couldn't speak English or had not gone to school, and he did do the legal work for them, wills and stuff like that, to see that their papers were drawn up properly. And he was a community builder and very much enjoyed his work too. There was at one time, and I was only told this, I believe it would have been in the 1930s, he was robbed. Because he was the paymaster for the elevator companies, and would have had amounts of $10,000 in his safe, which in the 1930s was a huge sum. And my uncle's had some checks uncashed in his safe. And the elevator company claimed that they should have cashed them and that we should not be responsible for replacing them. But Stevens again went to bat for them and said it was their right not to cash the checks if they so desired, and the company did forward new checks to them after the robbery.
Did Stevens' dealings with the people in the area mean that he sometimes ended up with farms that were repossessed? Was he a property owner to any extent, or?
Yes, he owned a lot of property, and this is how he got it. He would mortgage farms or make loans to farmers, and would be later forced, because of the depression, to foreclose on them. And he once told me that towards the end of the 1930s, he was nearly broke. And he told the bank, "Well, I'm going to throw it all on your desk if you so insist, or let me go and I might get through this." And he did, and became very successful. A very astute businessman, Mr. Stevens.
Quite a figure. I was living, of course, a few miles away, and quite aware of Mr. Stevens in general terms, but not in these specifics. Ab Thompson, the general storekeeper in Culross, fulfilled a few of those functions, but he wasn't anything like Dick Stevens' role in the Fannistel community. That's very interesting. Well, when did you become involved in running a farm?
I first rented land from my uncle in 1964. And it's a common joke amongst farmers that you should lose your first crop. It tempers the soul. But I didn't. I had a good crop.
Good for
And
you.
eventually took over the rest of the land from my dad, and eventually bought it from him. And I was married in 1966. And we began buying land from my parents bit by bit.
The land you rented would have been, what, a quarter section or
240 acres.
240 acres. Ah, those
Yes.
240 acre farms. Hey, what did your parents have? How much land?
560 acres.
So it was a little short of a section then, 80 acres short.
But in the horse era, a lot of that farm wasn't cultivated. Part of it was horse pasture, part of it was hay field. The horses ate a third of the farm,
Did they
basically.
really? It took a third of the
I
land
wouldn't
in.
say, I don't know if it was exactly a third, but just about. You needed a lot of pasture if you had a herd of 10 workhorses, and you needed a lot of hay. The straw was a main feed too after harvest. But after the horse era, and after the Second World War, as tractors became plentiful, a lot more land was plowed up, because all this hay field and horse pasture was turned into grain production. And that was a boost in the production of Western Canadian grain. The next big boost came with chemicals, which came out in the late 40s, I remember. The chemicals coming out. This was like outer space. You could pass a little mist of water over the wild mustard, and it poof, it was gone.
Right. So this, first of all, is herbicide we're talking about.
Yes.
In fact, I guess it is herbicides primarily you mean in terms of the chemicals,
Yes, herbicides.
because of course artificial fertilizers appear also. But let's focus on the herbicides for a bit. So you were spraying a crop by about 1950, would you
I
say,
was
or?
still a kid. I was watching. Oh, late 40s. My uncle had bought a rubber tired tractor in 47, I believe, and he did the spraying with it because the other tractors were on steel wheels, and they were putting on 4 ounces of 2,4-D, which was a very common broadleaf killer, at 3.5 gallons of water per acre. But you could make a pass across the field and the yellow was gone because wild mustard was becoming a very serious problem in Western Canada. It was a very competitive weed that would just choke the crop out. And that gave a big boost in production.
I remember doing a little bit of spraying myself at some point in the 50s, so part of that same experience. That was the main chemical, and 2,4-D it was for quite a little while as
Yes,
the herbicide of choice.
we were going after the easy kill group one weeds, they call them today, and they were the most prolific weeds, so they of course went after them first. The other group two weeds were harder to kill, and chemicals to control them came later, because when you take out the group one weeds, the group two weeds spring up in the vacuum. So my experience was with these harder to kill weeds more. Of course, you get the group ones too when you go for after the group twos. And then the third breakthrough in herbicide was the herbicides that would control the grassy weeds, the wild oats, wild millet, and those types of weeds, as wild oats sprung up. With the elimination of the other types of weeds, the wild oats proliferated.
There's always something growing.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Everything wants to grow. And I did many years spraying for wild oats and the broadleaf weeds.
Now, crop rotations and summer following were a standard part of the farming systems through the 50s and onwards.
Yes, I believe so. Summer fallowing was discovered in Saskatchewan at around the time of the Riel Rebellion, when some farmers were unable to obtain seed and had to leave the land lying fallow. The following year, they noticed that a big increase in the yield, and the practice got established. Now, we summer fallowed too, and you've seen an increase in yield because of the buildup of nitrogen. Nitrogen is created by lightning also. And then as the manufactured fertilizer started to come in the 60s in a big way, and yields were improved by that, the summer fallow began to decline because the farmers discovered that if you added the nitrogen and phosphate necessary, you could keep the yield up on your cropped fields. And today, here in the Red River Valley, I won't speak for Saskatchewan, but there is no summer fallow fields in the Red River Valley today. We call it continuous cropping. A crop is put in every year. There is crop rotations, and the types of crops grown in the Red River Valley are changing.
You want to sketch the rotations and the crops growing through the years of your experience up to the present?
Well, the most crops grown in my experience were wheat, hard red spring wheat, and malting barley was a big one, and it was a good one. Unfortunately, it was killed by the fungus Fusarium coming in, and it's a problem in hard wheat too. The Fusarium, sometimes called tombstone, Americans call it scab, but it's a fungus disease of cereal grains. And oats was another one, flax, and then canola came in. I remember when canola started to come in. It was called rapeseed then.
Sometime towards the late 60s, perhaps, or was it earlier than that?
Yeah, mid 60s, late 60s. And then it was a researcher in the University of Manitoba that developed what he called canola, the low uric acid form of rapeseed. And of course, they bred up new varieties. Canola or rapeseed is a plant that seems to work well with improving its genetics. Something like horses. If you want to breed horses up, you breed big ones, you get big horses. If you want to breed them down, you breed little ones, you get little ones. And canola seems to have that ability too. It responds well to some genetic manipulating, whereas I think wheat is a little tougher to manipulate genetically. It's been done too, and great varieties have been developed on the prairies for the prairie conditions, because the European varieties of French and English origin were too slow maturing for the short prairie growing season. Today, crops like winter wheat has come in, and when winter wheat started to come in, I said it'll take 10 years before you know if it's any good. And it's been about 10 years now, and it is good. It too is subject to fusarium. It's high yielding, and it's not a milling wheat in Canada. It's a feed class wheat, but it's high yielding. And it's matures quicker than spring wheat, not much quicker, about a week or 10 days. So it's taken off earlier.
So the attraction is to grow it for feed use and sale to the US as well, or?
Yes, the Wheat Board has overseas programs that they ship it overseas.
I see.
Other countries may use it for other purposes than just animal feed. Another use now is, of course, is ethanol with the fuel crisis.
Yes. Yeah, the way in which farming change has changed over the years. So the rotation that I'm so familiar with on growing up through the 50s is basically a three-field rotation, a very simple, I think, perhaps East European form, summer fallow wheat, oats, or perhaps flax, I suppose. Some barley was in there as well, and then back to summer fallow. It was really a 3-year rotation that my father followed, and it probably wasn't the best kind of farming. I know the McIntyres just down the road, who had a lot more land amongst them, the father and his four sons, did a good deal of clover growing and plowing it down. My father never took that up as still another feature of natural fertilizers, I suppose one could say, rather than the chemical fertilizers that were coming in through the 50s.
That's right, that my father practiced that 3-year rotation too of wheat, and followed by barley, or followed by flax, and then summer fallow. That was the common way of doing it. Yeah, there was quite a bit of plow down clover, they called it. It's very good for the land. It's expensive to plow down, but someday I suspect we'll go back to that as we deplete the organic matter in the soil. It's going to have to be rebuilt.
We might talk later about the wisdom of continuous cropping, but in any case, that was the kind of farming that developed, and you went to that as well, I suppose, at some point
Yes.
in your experience.
Yeah, when I started farming on my own, I was still with that practice, and then got into heavier chemical fertilizer and continuous cropping. Continuous cropping helps for returning organic matter to the soil if you don't burn it. And burning in the Red River Valley has become an issue.
Yes, I see that in the Free Press. The treatment of the stubble and the straw, of course, is an interesting matter, both to some extent technically and for other reasons, because the combines, the threshing machines produced a big pile of straw. The combines opened several possibilities. One was just dropping it in a swath that could be easily burned, or spreading it in a way that might feed the soil. And what experiences or thoughts do you have about this matter of the straw? So there was a time in the 50s when you could, in the fall, you could look in every direction and see the fires at night as farmers burned their fields off.
Well, part of the problem in the Red River Valley is it's difficult to incorporate this straw into the heavy clay soils. And the following year, the straw is not broken down in the spring, and you have difficulty working the land, getting another crop in. There's been a lot of improvement in equipment to get the straw chopped finely and spread, and including the chaff.
Because there were attachments put on the combines that chopped up the straw, wasn't it? Instead yes. of just spreading it as...
Yes. No, it's not. It's chopped very finely now and spread as wide as possible so that it doesn't lie in rows. And, of course, nitrogen fertilizer breaks down the straw, but you have to put on more fertilizer. And when the straw is decayed, it gives back up that nitrogen. And another problem is when the farmers are burning straw and the smoke drifts into the city of Winnipeg, the fighting is on.
Right. They don't like that in the city.
I myself had the experience of being in hospital one night when the smoke drifted heavily into Winnipeg, and between the hospital smell and the smoke creeping into the hospital, it was the most sickening odor. But and I sympathized with the people. I don't like smoke myself and would avoid all burning, but in some cases it is just necessary in this Red River Valley. But with the improvement of equipment...
Yes, what were those changes in cultivation, tillage equipment over the years?
Well, the European farmer and even the early pioneers believed in moldboard plowing, turning the straw under. Now, in the days of the separator, the straw was off. It was only the stubble left, so they moldboard plowed. But with the advent of the dust storms of the dirty 30s, they had to come up with a different method of working the land and not exposing it to the wind like the moldboard plow does. So they came out with some call them duckfoot cultivators. It was a V-shaped cultivator shovel that would slip under the straw but leave it on the surface to break the wind and hold the soil in. And we've gone entirely to that now. In the very light soil zones, they're gone to what they call zero tillage. They don't till at all anymore. But in the Red River Valley, they work the land with these cultivators, heavy cultivators, in the fall to break it up, but leave the straw on the surface to prevent erosion. And last spring, in the spring of 07, we had a terrible dust storm through here that was 2 days of black blowing soil that filled many ditches, and in the RM I live in here, I believe it was $1.2 million cleanup to get this soil out of the drainage ditches and back into the fields.
That's very serious. There, I want to ask you in two different directions, but let's stick with tillage for a moment. There were discs, one-way discs, smaller machines, and then the bigger discers that came in between the moldboard plow and these cultivators. And did your family not use the
yes.
The one-way?
Yes, we did. I cut my teeth on a disker. The disker was made by Co-op Implements, Canadian Cooperative Implements Limited in Winnipeg. It was a Saskatchewan farmer that invented it, and it was a one-way disc that cut the soil and turned it over. And they became very popular in the early 50s. Everybody had one. And they had seeding attachments on them. So yeah. We all went to seeding the crop with these diskers. Only the co-op was officially called the disker. The others couldn't use that copyrighted name, but amongst the farmers, they were all diskers.
Like Kleenex and a few other brand right. names that became generic.
Aspirin. I can't even name another brand of Kleenex. It's just Kleenex.
Right.
But,
but these were superseded by those cultivators you're describing.
Yes.
Deep tillage cultivators.
Deep tillage cultivators.
They were also called sometimes.
And then another thing that came in, and it too was a Saskatchewan invention, was they called the air seeder or air drill. And it was a system of two tanks on it and a large fan on it that blows the grain and fertilizer through tubes behind these shovels and seeds the crop in that way. They're called air seeders or air drills.
And they're working in conjunction with these deep tillage cultivators. behind the shank on
Yes,
the elevator.
they were in the light soil areas, but that
Yeah.
wouldn't work in this heavy
No, I
soil
wouldn't
area
think so.
of the Red River Valley. So there's a great many people working on developing openers that would work in this clay soil. And there's a great variety of openers that have been developed that do work in this soil. When I first seen them, I said it won't work in Red River mud. But they are working today and they're working fine. And because of their convenience, one farmer is able to seed a lot more land.
Isn't that interesting?
Because you fill up your tanks and you seed quite a few acres before you have to stop to fill again. And it's not necessary to harrow the land and pack it in behind them. They have packer wheels on them so that when you're finished seeding, you're finished the field. It's ready to grow. So one farmer, one man can farm more acres today than ever before.
So in the Red River Valley, this would be after the initial mechanization, then one of the most important advances in the equipment, I take it.
Yes, it is, yes.
The soil drifting that I've experienced in the 50s as well, and you're describing it also at a later time, was not in our area confronted very much by the planting of shelter belts, I don't think. If you go into some areas, and I was driving to around Winkler to Carmen to Winkler earlier this fall, and noticing when you begin looking, you realize that there are still some of these rows of trees dividing fields up, and those trees may conceivably date back to the 30s, I guess, when out of the United States, this was emphasized heavily as a way to break up the movement of the wind and, of course, the carrying of the soil. But I don't know that the Kilross-Fannastell area saw very much of that at all.
No, we didn't. When you talk of the Winkler area, that is a very light type of soil. And if it does get eroding by wind, it just turns into a desert and they lose topsoil going into the air. Whereas the heavier soil of the Red River Valley doesn't tend to get airborne, it just gets into the ditch and
Yes,
fills it.
gets carried to the ditch, all right. My brother and I had a bunch of gopher traps along the half mile south of the farm one year when this wind carried dirt into that ditch. And I guess the steel is still in that ditch down there, unless it's been cleaned out since then. I just don't know. But that was one of those experiences of soil loss to the ditches that I well remember in a dry year. And of course, the farming is so much influenced by wet and dry, isn't it? The vagaries of the
Yes,
weather.
yes. I always envisioned, I had my farm all drawn out for where the hedges would go, but it causes a problem in the heavy soil too, in that in the winter it stops snow drifts, and in the spring when you need drying, which is limited in the Red River because of the heavy soil, it's wet along the hedgerows, so you can't work your fields. Also, hedgerows are not a good thing to have when you've got great big wide equipment and you've got to turn around. So you'll even see them plowing up or bulldozing up the hedgerows in the lighter soil zones, and they do control soil drifting with the equipment they use to keep a trash cover, as we call it, on the soil so it won't blow. Fields that are badly prone to drifting is fields that have beans on them or potatoes, as they don't have a heavy residue cover. And it can be a problem in dry years. Fortunately, it doesn't happen too many years on the prairies, but it can be a problem. The farmer's best efforts can be defeated. Like last spring, it was 2 days of a natural disaster when you have. We had one day of very high wind, followed by another day of even higher wind. Well, your best efforts are defeated against a calamity like that, and they were. Although a lot of fields did not drift, and that was due to a good practice of keeping the fields covered with with trash so that the wind can't erode them. And we're doing much better all over Western Canada in soil erosion control. Mm-hmm. The 1930s were a real learning curve for the people that came from Europe and the West and the East, mm-hmm. To farm these conditions.
Things had to be learned, didn't they? I take it from something you said just in passing, that you had a vision of what the farm should become when you took over your parents' farm. You referred to hedgerows and so on. Did you? Were there other elements in the way in which you were going to develop the farm once it was under your control?
Much more drainage work. My dad would always say to me, this would be such better land if it had a roll to it and would drain. But what we discovered was it had enough of up and down to it.
Enough slope
to it. Yes, it had enough slope, but these low spots were impounded. You had to cut through a ridge to drain the water out. So we began doing that. And of course, it had to be with the levels of government too. They had to make, the provincial government had to make the major drains, the municipal government had to make drains going into these major drains, and then the farmers drained their fields. Now, when I was growing up in the 50s, I remember a prominent drain by the farm called the Allen Creek Channel, which is still there, and it would drain for a month. There would be big flocks of wild geese and ducks in it. And now, basically, in 4 or 5 days, it's drained. The land, the water rushes off the land into these major drains and goes holus bolus towards the river.
And so this is a fast drainage off the farmland, and that is the key factor, you mean, and you think in terms of the quick rain.
Yes, and it gives you an earlier seeding season, mm-hmm. and a longer one. And the earlier you put your crops in, the better your yields are. Your crop is established when the summer heat comes on it.
There are very interesting interconnections here, aren't there? And I'm thinking of my own experience, my father's experience, not many miles from your farm. In the 50s, the relationship between his activities, the municipality, Cameron McIntyre, half a mile down the road, our councillor for Ward 2, the back 80 acres at our 240 acres was located right next to 80 acres, mostly of bush. And of course that bush held snow into the spring. And so there were low spots in this 80 acres that for years he couldn't farm properly. And then one year he had the help, I believe, of the McIntyres with some of the earth moving equipment that they'd acquired. It was a dry year, so he was able to get the ditches cut to the side of the end of the 80 acres. And then the municipality came along and deepened the ditch along that road. There was no one living for several miles, I think, along that particular road, but the ditch was deepened. And the combination then was that the field, the 80 acres, would drain, the slough was gone, the water flowed into this ditch that had been deepened by municipality. And away it went, and the 80 acres became much easier to cultivate and became profitable for Dad in the way it had been before. And I expect that you're referring to some similar things on your farm or in the neighborhood.
Very similar, yes. The whole Red River Valley would tell the same story. It's flat, and it's heavy clay soil, and it requires drainage because it just will not absorb the spring runoff. And there's been, in the last 100 years, extensive drainage done in the Red River. And there's some controversy over that. Getting back to hedgerows, it would be better for wind protection, wildlife, but farmers find out that bringing wildlife back is not such a good idea after all. When you get a lot of deer habitat and they eat the wife's garden, the deer aren't too liked anymore. So there is problems with hedgerows that will, I don't ever see them coming into prominence anymore under present farming conditions. And drainage, now there's people that are saying we've drained too much, we've drained all the wetlands. The Red River Valley was a giant wetland of waterfowl territory, and we have drained it entirely. But I think you'll find that all over the world, that the good land is basically the wetlands, and when they're drained, they make good productive farmland.
Yes, indeed, and they get pressed into service, into put under cultivation, and so on. You mentioned just in passing the wife's garden, and it's hardly grain production, and yet the survival of the family on these farms to continue grain production, it often depends on the production of the garden. What was the experience on your farm? Did you and your wife
well,
do a good deal of gardening?
When we were growing up, the garden was very important, and a lot of it was preserved, plus a big bin of potatoes. We were a family of five kids, so that was seven people, and it took a lot of food. And at that time, you didn't get asparagus from California in January. You relied on the food that was preserved, potatoes, sauerkraut, and carrots in a bin of dirt. For your fresh vegetables. As we were growing up with, my wife is an avid gardener, and we had a garden, and she preserved a lot of it too, but it's of less importance today because farm families are small, and they are so big that the garden is not the income producer it once was. Many farm women work off the farm today too and don't have the time to put a garden in.
Well, my mother certainly gardened a great deal, and the potato rows and the other vegetables and the canning, the big, what were they, half-gallon sealers that
yes.
used to be used. And even meat was canned. I remember mother doing putting
yes.
up chicken, which would come out of these jars then cold with the gelatin around it and so on and so forth. Perfectly good meat. But that's not done anymore either, I don't suppose.
I love canned chicken, and it was something you could just open up and make yourself a lunch out of. But prior to 1948, we did not have rural electrification or refrigeration, so canning was important. It had to be canned. It couldn't be frozen. Today, there's a lot more freezing going on than canning.
What was the impact of rural electrification beginning in 1948?
Well,
what did you see on the farm?
I say it freed the slaves.
Just the boys.
You wouldn't,
and the girls too.
Both. But in the household, you wouldn't believe the amount of electrical horsepower you got working for you. And if you didn't have it, you pumped water. You carried ashes out. You carried wood in. It was all muscle power. It took two women working in the farm kitchen to keep things going. And on the farm, another big factor was safety. I remember us as kids, no, you can't have a lamp in the basement because of the hazard of the coal oil lamps. But when the house was electrified, well, you just flicked the switch on. And I believe the monthly hydro bills were like $4 or $6.
Power at cost.
And on the farm, it allowed power tools. It evolved slowly. You didn't just go to run to Rona and get all these wonderful power tools that they have today. It evolved slowly. You bought this and that, and in the barn, lights in the barn instead of the hazardous lantern in the hay. And the fact that you could now plug your Chevy in and it would start in the wintertime was a big factor. The RM then began to plow roads all winter, because I can still remember my dad bringing in a load of flour and 100 pounds of oatmeal in the fall. And then the old Ford 36 Ford was put in the shed and the water drained out of the block and it stayed there till spring. So with the coming of electricity, that ended.
Mm-hmm.
You had a block heater on the tractor. You could use the tractor for cleaning snow or horse, whichever you wished. And the car could go all winter.
My life was impacted by some of these things and that transition. I was almost seven when I started school in the fall of 1948, and I remember my father preparing for the challenge. He held me back, or my parents did, because my brother was something over a year younger, and he didn't want to be responsible for getting me to school for 2 years by myself. The following year, my brother would be starting in grade one and I'd be in grade two. So that was the plan. But what he did to prepare for what he thought would be necessary was to build a caboose, which would be horse-drawn. And I remember his bringing these oak planks home and in the wintertime heating them in boiling water in order to put the bend on the front part of the plank so that it would be a proper runner. And he did. He built this caboose, which sat on the farm north of Culross for years. I don't know that it was ever used, horses pulling it, in the winter for transportation, because I think about 1948, I guess power came in, the McIntyres or the municipality began clearing the roads. He could get me to town by car and so on. So it was just that sort of transition point that happened in there with this relic of the earlier times no longer needed.
Yes, I remember that on our farm too. The horse-drawn sleigh that I went to school with, it got parked and was no longer used. And I did go to school by horse in the early years. And gradually the RM began to plow the roads and it all became obsolete.
Well, I used the cart. We used the cart later on at Gilt Edge School when you and I first met it.
I remember that cart.
Fall of 1953 when we were going to Gilt Edge School, which had been newly opened. And my father built the two-wheeled cart and the horse, and I guess a half a dozen of us could get inside. And we picked up little Yvette Bass on the way by her place on the way to school. And that's, where you and I met.
Yes. Yes, it seems long ago now, and it is
half a century ago and more.
We are now old timers.
So the farming, we've mentioned the role of the rural municipality in making the life of farmers easier, improving the roads and digging the ditches and so on and so forth. Of course, this was part based on the tax base. The farmers paid their rates and so on and so forth. There were other organizations that were important to farmers as well, and I expect that you've had involvement. Well, you did mention your uncle being on the pool committee at Fannistel in 1926, was it?
Yes. Yes, in the forming of the Manitoba Pool local at Fannistel. He was on that board, and they delivered grain to the farmers felt, and with some justification, that the private grain trade was not serving their interests. And so they established their own grain handling system, first through United Grain Growers, which was established in 1906. And it's interesting reading the first 50 years of United Grain Growers. And then the pools were formed later in the 20s and became the biggest grain handler on the prairies.
Do you have a sense of why the pools were created, given that there was, Grain Growers and the Grain Growers Grain Company and preceding that and so on? Why did the pools appear? Any sense of that? Was it a...
I can't really answer that.
Was it a comment on the failure of UGG?
The Grain Growers was... Grain Growers was not a direct cooperative. It was a sort of a corporate cooperative. You by patronizing them, you were granted shares in the company, whereas the pools were a direct cooperative. Profits were shared amongst the farmers. United Grain Growers was not prominent in the Red River Valley. They were very prominent in Alberta, and somewhat in Saskatchewan. They didn't come into Manitoba prominently until they bought the Canadian Consolidated Grain Company out. Then UGG became a big player in Manitoba.
I suppose it may have been that other companies came in too early established themselves at many of these points, and so there wasn't really an opportunity. You need the cooperation of the railway company too, I suppose, to have the siding space and so on and so forth, although the pools clearly got that.
Yes, well, that's, I believe, by legislation, the railways do have to serve any customer. But it's possible that Manitoba, being the oldest of the grain-growing provinces, had other elevator companies established, as there was a great variety of elevator companies in Western Canada.
Yes.
That have got long disappeared from the scene.
Were you involved with the pool over the years yourself as a producer?
I wasn't involved with pool. I got involved with United Grain Growers when they moved into Fennistil. And I served as local chairman on the board for several years. And I patronized United Grain Growers, mostly.
Was there any particular reason for your choice of UGG there then over the pool?
They were both good. Sometimes it was just a preference of the local buyer is why.
The elevator agent.
Not that I would say anyone was bad. It's just that you had to deliver to one company, and if the buyer was being good to you, well, you were good to him and delivered your production to him.
Now, the good would not involve price particularly, because the wheat board would be setting that, would it?
Yes.
Or were there price differences?
The wheat board on the wheat board grains would set the price. Mm-hmm. The company would issue you the check, but it was actually, grain actually belongs to the wheat board, still does. As services, at that time, there was still feed, fertilizer, and chemical.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes played a role.
So UGG would be selling that as the pool would as well. Or did the pool work in cooperation with the cooperatives? What was the relationship?
The retail cooperatives, no, they were separate. And in the early years of Manitoba Pool Elevators, each local was separate. They sort of incorporated under a central board in later years.
Was there a co-op store in Fennistil?
No.
So I know there was one in Elm Creek.
There's one in Elm Creek, and it's
which
still
Archie
there.
Which Archie Jensen ran for many years, back in my day.
Yes. I also served on the co-op board, which was an interesting experience. But the retail co-ops are totally separate from the pool elevator system, which is gone now. But the local co-op, such as Elm Creek, is owned by the shareholders of the local co-op. Federated Cooperative is owned by the retail co-ops and supplies the retails.
So there's a local, a group of local shareholders then who have come together to establish this cooperative store.
Yes.
The one that Elm Creek we're talking about and the others.
Yes.
And
yes.
They then came together to establish a central, I suppose, buying agency for themselves. Federated.
Yeah, which is federated. Yes, it's the wholesaler. I also served on the co-op board, which is very interesting because when I got on the board, it was very near bankruptcy in Elm Creek. So very near that the federated was just going to pull the pin on us, which is a farmer's expression, pulling the pin. but we got on the board and we turned it around and...
When was this? Over what period of time?
That would have been in the 70s, early 70s.
The years of the great inflation of prices and so on.
It was, and it was the good years that got us in trouble.
Was it now?
Managers were too lax on credit. Sometimes it was difficult to get a good manager because there were so many good jobs out there that it was hard to get a good manager. Now, when grain prices collapsed and things got tough, it was easy to get a good manager. And we were broke. We were so broke that we even forgave our director's fees, which was $10 a meeting. And it amounted to $1,000 a year.
But you couldn't afford it.
We couldn't afford it. The $1,000 went into the co-op. And this went on for a couple of years. And we turned it around today. We turned it around at that time. And today it's a thriving co-op with full services to the local community.
So this would be one of your satisfactions from farming life.
It was.
To save the Elm Creek co-op.
I dealt with that co-op all my farming years. They supplied me with my fuel needs. And it was good for me. I earned a yearly dividend. I earned a good equity out of the co-op, which was paid out to me when I retired. And... I always had good service and good bookkeeping. So what more can you ask for?
Well, that's right. And the fuel would be delivered to your farm by tank truck.
Yes.
Yeah. Who was in competition on the fuel delivery? What was there?
Oh, there was many. There was more in earlier days. Towards the end, Shell and Imperial Oil were the competition, the corporate competition.
Centralized.
Yes. Earlier, there was more grain oil companies, just like there was many other companies. There was North Star Oil that I recall. There was British American Oil. But it was coalescing to fewer and fewer suppliers.
Become Gulf and be taken over by Petro-Canada, wasn't that? I think it was how Petro-Canada in the 70s
yes, I think so.
Developed its system. Yeah, so I remember Ab Thompson had the, I don't know, ton and a half trucker or whatever. He would haul those 45-gallon barrels.
Yes, yes. Well, the co-op did too. It started with barrels. yes, and you...
And then the 500-gallon tanks went up on the farms.
Yes.
On their legs, and gravity feed into the vehicle and so on. And then I guess they had to have tank trucks to pump the fuel up into those tanks,
yes.
I suppose.
Yes. And then today what's common is the big, what we call skid tanks. It's a tank that's on the ground on skids, and it has an electric pump on it. I had one of those, and it was a beautiful way of handling fuel. Of course, you got to be very careful with the environment today of fuel spills.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the way fuel is delivered to farms today. At 13 gallons an hour when you're thrashing, you need a bit of a fuel supply.
Yes, indeed. You certainly do. The well, a couple of concerns for the later years that you just suggested in the last moments. Of course, the further development of the machinery, larger and larger machinery developing. When you you retired in...
2002 was my last crop.
6 years ago from our
yes.
taping this. And what kind of stock of equipment did you have at the retirement point?
I wasn't the biggest farmer out there.
You were farming how many acres?
800 acres.
800 acres.
A gross of 800.
A good Red River Valley farm.
Very, yes. There was, as I checked the auction sales in the farm papers, so many farmers with almost identical equipment to mine are being auctioned off. And Bill Clausen is the prominent auctioneer in this area.
As Cam so, Johnson used to do it out of Carmen.
Yes, yeah, today it's Bill. And he's a good auctioneer. I had him for 2 auction sales, and he did a very good job of it. But that size of farmer is going out. And today, I don't know, a land base of 2,400 acres for one farmer is almost getting small.
So that's four sections, rather. 640,
yes.
A bit over 4
yes.
sections, or a little under. Because it'd be 1280, 2560, I guess, would be 4 sections, would it? In any case, into that range.
Yeah.
How much equipment did you actually have?
I ended with 2 case tractors, a one with 110 horsepower and one was 130. 2-wheel drive with dual wheels on them. And I also did 10 years with a Russian combine.
Russia.
They were imported from Russia.
Mm-hmm.
They were called Don 1500s. I was looking for a bigger combine, and they were cheap. And I thought, well, I'm really sticking my neck out buying this, because I don't know nothing about it, and it was still a lot of money. It was under $70,000.
Who was selling them?
There was a dealer north of Winnipeg that had a...
That was importing.
Who didn't stay there very long. And I bought it, and it was a thrasher. It could thrash, and it was fuel efficient. I still say the Russians know something about fuel efficiency that our guys don't. I would burn 67 gallons an hour where my neighbors were saying, well, 10, well, 11. And I would keep up with them.
Yeah, 6 to 7 gallons.
Per hour,
yeah.
Yes.
And the machine worked well.
It worked well. I did blow a motor out of it, though. That was the big problem with it. A wrist pin went on one of the pistons, and I had to put in a rebuilt motor. And then I just continued thrashing with it until I finished farming.
Mm-hmm.
It had a lot of good points. The basic thrashing machine was good, but it needed some North American finesse on it. The Russians are rough. I even talked to them, and they say, well, why do you want that? Well, just make it a little more streamlined. They don't seem to think that's necessary.
Something to square lines, eh?
Yes. A good aesthetic improvement of the machine would have made it look more appealing.
Sure.
The basic thrashing machine was good. It thrashed good, and I thrashed with it for 10 years.
This was a self-propelled combine like the others.
Yes.
Yeah, because I guess everyone was self-propelled by the 60s.
Air-conditioned cab on it, and
both of your tractors had air-conditioned cabs on them as well.
Yes.
When did they get that come in?
That would have come in around... Well, it was getting very common by 1970. I would think there was cabs earlier, but they were poor. They were metal cabs with no air conditioning systems in them, and they were noisy and dusty. But once the sealed air conditioned cab came in, it became a joy to be out there in the field, and
kept the dust.
The heater. Cold
keeps you warm.
Yes,
or air conditioning for cooling. And
you're so immobilized when you're sitting on a tractor that you just freeze on a cold day because you can't move much more than your fingers. But when you had a heater, and I think that's why a lot of farmers farmed, even though they were older, because of the air conditioned cab and the heated cab.
The actual
yes,
work,
eh? Because as you get older, you aren't as tough.
No.
And
of course, farmers did in decades past. They'd be retiring by 50 or whatever. As soon as the boys were old, they'd have to take over. The old man would slide aside, I suppose.
Yes, but in my generation, there was a lot of farmers that had small families and sent their kids to university or to the colleges to learn a trade. The boys mm-hmm. weren't interested in farming. So it became less... that the sons took over the farm.
Yes. And that, of course, keeps a man farming longer, too, because he farms it out and then sells the farm. That's his pension, I suppose.
Yes. Yes. I know my grandfather, well, I don't think he could have understood what the word retirement was. As he got older, he just fell to the lighter chores, the chickens, the garden. But
the son was taking over.
Yes. The sons did the heavy work. And he did the lighter work as he got old.
Yes.
But today, many farmers have no son that's going to take over the farm, so they do sell out, and the neighbor buys in or rents the land, as I rent mine. And fortunately, I have a couple of young fellows that are farming it and doing a very good job of it.
Yeah. The equipment would include, I'm thinking of the cultivator we've talked about. You'd have a good sized one of that, I suppose.
Yes.
And the